I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Revisiting Ireland and a 100-year-old fragment of history, the Easter Rising of 1916. It marked the beginning of the end for British rule. On a post-colonial globe, it resonates uncannily to this day.
God most merciful and kind, on this Easter day of new beginnings, we remember the men, the women, and the children of 1916.
That Easter weekend, just a century ago, was the opening act of an insurrection that flopped, as if the British redcoats had smashed our patriots at Concord and Lexington. In Ireland, that week in 1916, about 500 people died, half of them civilians.
Thomas J. Clark, Sean Mock Germida, Thomas McDonough, P.H. Pierce.
The British execution of those rebels was unmerciful, and it backfired some, setting most of Ireland on a long course toward independence and republic. Along the way, civil war, partition of the island north and south, and emigration all sapped free Ireland. In the 1990s, the Celtic tiger of tech and speculation romped through Ireland, but in the 08 meltdown, the tiger emigrated too. We asked a radio pro and friend of ours, Eamon Little, in County Galway, to ask some of his neighbors to read the Easter Rebels' proclamation from 1916, their version of our Declaration of Independence, and also to think aloud about how the last century has gone.
We declare the right of the people of Ireland to the ownership of Ireland and to the unfettered control of Irish destinies
to be sovereign and indefeasible.
The Republic guarantees religious and civil liberty, equal rights and equal opportunity to all its citizens.
And declares its resolve to pursue the happiness and prosperity of the whole nation and of all its parts.
Cherishing of all the children of the nation equally.
So, 100 years on, how are we doing?
Wouldn't that be nice if that had actually happened? Women haven't had equal opportunities and equal rights up until the 70s in Ireland. So you kind of wonder,
you know, did we live up to it?
Oh, I'd say in certain aspects, yeah. And certain aspects, no as well, you know, yeah. It's kind of a bit of both, yeah.
Well, we haven't lived up to it. And I think in some ways what we've done basically as a free country is maintain the status quo that was there when the British ruled Ireland.
One of my favourite things I ever heard a lecturer say was, the English conquered the Irish, but the Irish conquered the English. That's our monuments. In the written word and just in our personalities.
Even when things are bad, like when we suffer that recession, we knuckled down, we took it on the chin, things went wrong, we just got on with it.
What do you think about our society in terms of fairness and equality and equal opportunity?
Well, it's not equal. It's not equal. That's the top and the bottom of it, you know. Like, for instance, the 1916 Rising was commemorated outside the GPO, do you know? Well, all you have to do is to go down the streets and you have blocks of homeless people, do you know? So, is that equal? It could be a lot better, let's put it that way, yeah.
I think what's important in Ireland in terms of a vision for the future and what people value, we still haven't thrown off the shackles of our colonial past, of a repressed past. We're not inclined to plan. You can see the current debacle in trying to form a government at the moment reflected in that.
But just looking forward now into the future, let's think about the next 100 years. Yeah. You know, what kind of a country would you hope we would have?
More just, I'd hope. More equal, more free. I hope that we take the best out of the last century and not the worst.
We have the benefit this hour of Granta magazine's gathering up of original writing from Ireland's best. Not so much to celebrate a centennial as to notice, dramatize, reimagine, and make literary art, as the Irish are wont to do, of their lives at many levels. The prolific novelist and essayist Colm Tobin leads off in our studio. He wrote the novel that became the heartthrob hit movie Brooklyn, about the young girl, Elish Lacey, emigrating to New York in the 1950s from Colm Tobin's hometown, Enniscorthy. Funny thing about your town, come to being, it was the only spot outside Dublin that the rebels hit hard in 1916 and held for a moment or more. How does Enniscorthy observe the centennial?
Well, there was a very big march from all over the countryside into the centre of the town on Easter Monday this year. And the proclamation was read, again, using the Irish army, you know, the official state apparatus. Great numbers attended, and it was I think, very proudly dealt with in a way that wasn't necessarily, you know, it wasn't going to be, it was a commemoration, you know, but it wasn't actually a celebration. I mean, people were aware that many people had been killed and that and that it was something that still was open to question.
Did people die in Enniscorthy?
No.
Fascinating. You know, I've read your very long piece in the London Review of Books about 1916 over and over. And I want you to deal with it as sort of surface the unmasking that's going on. In your telling of the story, there's more than a little crackpotism in it, an eccentricity and an odd circle of conspirators. Introduce some of them. Thomas Clarke, for example, or yeah, James Connolly, the one that I always come back to.
I mean, I think more than, say, the French Revolution, if you call 1916 a revolution, it depended much more on individuals than it did on a crowd. And that Thomas Clarke, for example, was an old fenian, meaning that, you know, no matter what he thought about, it was to get the English out of Ireland. He was single-minded. Yeats would have dealt hearts with one purpose alone through summer and winter seem enchanted to a stone to trouble the living stream. And what he needed to do was then to gather with him other forces, forces that, say, 6 or 7 years earlier, before the rebellion, might have had different priorities. Patrick Pearse being one, who was essentially a language enthusiast. James Connolly on the other side being a labour leader who was interested in socialism. Right. So what Clarke needed to do was to bring all of these people with him towards the rebellion. 3 or 4 years earlier, it would have seemed impossible. But just as the First World War broke out, as militarism increased, that possibility increased of simply bringing together three or four important strands within, say, Irish public life. And a number of very determined individuals could then, without any particular mandate, even from their own organisations, lead a rebellion in Dublin. It's hard to think what the British could have done other than shoot them. I mean, this is in the middle of the First World War. But once the British did shoot them, the Irish side saw them, they had become very used to them. They saw them as people who were not necessarily criminals, who were not necessarily rebels only, but who had played a large part in public life in the country. And they were buried in quicklime without coffins. So there were no funerals. That horrified people in Ireland. And of course, on the British side, it seemed absolutely right. So within a few days of shooting them in the House of Commons, John Dillon, who was an Irish parliamentary, member of the Irish Parliamentary Party, was not a supporter of the rebellion, pointed out to the British what they had just done. They had undone constitutional nationalism for a generation. And everything he said, that's a debate on the 11th of May, James Connolly and one other, Sean McDermott, were shot the following day even, just saying these executions are maddening Ireland. And the British simply didn't understand. People booed him, other members of the House of Commons. So what the rebellion really did was it established a great gap between Irish, what we might call public opinion, and British public opinion.
In your hindsight, the legend of Easter 16, including the Yeats poem, which came some after an interval, but the O'Casey plays and this sort of thing, seems to have been a kind of literary invention. And the other, with the interesting twist, that the greatest of the literary men, notably Joyce and Yeats, were barely interested in politics. And Yeats in the poem is very, very ambivalent.
Yes, I mean, I think that it almost was like a poem itself. Its job was not necessarily to take Dublin Castle or to produce an army larger than the British army, but was to have an influence on people's imaginations. So to that extent, it had a literary force, which was much greater, for example, than its military impact.
There was a nasty crack from a fellow we know in Ireland this week who said, you know, it was a bit of ISIS about it. It was reckless. It was done for effect, emotional effect, without necessarily a plan to win.
Yes, we always have people who are interested in anachronism and being ahistorical. I mean, those people have always been with us. I mean, we have to see it in the context, really, of the First World War and of the efforts to produce Home Rule in Ireland, which had, of course, begun with the arming of the Ulster Volunteers, you know, in 1914. So the sort of guns were everywhere. And so that these people had a dream. But Thomas Clarke did not. He was not a dreamer. He was absolutely intent on this idea of getting the British out of Ireland. But he had no other plan. I mean, it's not as though, even though the proclamation is filled with these very broad things, none of them really had any, other than James Connolly, had a great sort of social vision of what sort of society would be created. And I notice there's nothing in the proclamation about the use of the Irish language, for example, even though Patrick Pearse was a great language enthusiast. So while the broadness of the proclamation, which we've just heard, inspired people, it wasn't actually a blueprint for the creation of a society. It meant that almost any place, as long as the British were not in charge of it, could come into being. And that, in a way, has hampered, you know, simply because we weren't able to move away from Britain in the same way as Canada or Australia, in a, you know, in a slow and parliamentary way, with led by policymakers. I think it made a difference to the country, to its detriment, I think.
Nothing but ironies here and tensions between the terror and the beauty, and this sort of thing, we'll come back to it all. Nothing more ironic than the fact that many more Irish men fought in World War One with Britain then we're ready to rise up. It's open source doctrine that novelists see more than the rest of us of what's hidden in plain sight. Coming up from the rising generation in Ireland, Colin Barrett of Young Skins, Lisa McInerney of The Glorious Heresies, Mary O'Donoghue of Before the House Burns, and Belinda McKeown of the novel Solace and Tender. This is Open Source. Century to century, writing is the prized Irish crop. We just heard the old patriotic claim that Ireland wrote a huge swath of the best prose, poetry, and drama in English. Beckett and Behan, Swift and Shaw, Oscar Wilde and Edna O'Brien among them. And always the buzz is about the up and coming. First in our sampling this week is Colin Barrett. We've been reading his debut collection of stories, Young Skins, honored for capturing the bleakness of a small town in the west of Ireland, the cadences of barroom bouncers, fry cooks, drug traffickers that he knew growing up in County Mayo.
There's a kind of straight-faced slyness. They're laconic and they're people of few words sometimes, but very playful people once you get to know them. But you do got to get to know them. Small, very interior world, remote geographically, and with its own set of inside rules and rituals, was what was fascinating to me.
Colin, I'd ask you to just stand way back. We're thinking of 100 years, in a way, arbitrarily, since 1916. If Yeats or Joyce or Sean O'Casey, if they were watching these towns with you and trying to single out the most important changes, what would they notice above all, do you suppose?
An early reader of the collection called it a post-Christian Irish book. And it's possibly what they would notice the most, because I think there's still a lot of things that someone like Joyce in these characters, you know, he wouldn't have any problem recognizing. But there's almost this sort of amnesia. There's no overt connection to the past, you know. These characters don't have anything to inherit. Even structurally, the nuclear family is a rare thing in these collections. Most of the family units are, you know, don't conform to that conventional nuclear family. So it's that lack of an inheritance, and it's just a sort of a bit of a void. And I think it's difficult for a lot of people. Then you have to try and fill up your life with meaning when a lot of the old meanings and that you would have inherited or took for granted have been, you know, jettisoned, really.
Lisa McInerney began with a dark-minded blog recounting real life in public housing in Cork and Galway. She's heralded now as a novelist for The Glorious Heresies, due out in the US in August.
If you think about the Irish psyche, and you think about these things that have happened and the idea of the Celtic Tiger coming in and then suddenly leaving, this idea of a boom and a bust, our identity being up in a heap, I guess in that sense you would be drawn towards writing about the darker side of life, or looking at the darker side of life and kind of redefining Ireland in not necessarily glowing terms. I guess in that sense violence would come into it. I think in a lot of cases as well, it's very much tied into the way we look at alcohol, the way alcohol feeds into a lot of things in Ireland, which again is, you know, quite an unfortunate stereotype, but it's very much there. Especially, I think in Colin Barrett's stories, that whole idea of being kind of stuck in a very dead-end small town and all these energy of the young people, you know, where does it go? What do you do with it? It does get funneled into very much dark places. I wonder if showing these, you know, very dark facets of Irish life is a way of trying to redefine Ireland after such an enormous cultural shift. I mean, things don't necessarily feel that bright or feel that pleasant here at the moment. It's been a century of, I think, one birth pang after another, really. I mean, 1916 was the rising, but we didn't get our full independence until many years after that. And then we went straight into a civil war. And then when we drafted our constitution, we invited probably far too much input from the Catholic Church. And then we had, you know, decades of a lot of social restriction, and then we had recessions. And so in that sense, it hasn't felt like, you know, one smooth movement from 1916 to now. I think that it's not only now, perhaps, we've got enough of a grip on our national identity, who we are, where we want to go, that hopefully, that the next century will be a lot easier to navigate.
This is a report from On Ireland from the writers. Mary O'Donoghue grew up in County Clare on the West. She teaches at Babson College outside Boston. Belinda McCune grew up in Longford in the Heartland. She teaches at Rutgers. I want you to just give us the widest, most tempting introduction to Irish writing today. What are you up to, Mary? Speak for your generation.
I think I'd like to talk about it in terms of what I've looked in on over the last, I would say, 5 to 7 years. And you've heard from Colin Barrett, you've heard from Lisa McInerney. There seems to be a tremendously lively wrangling with some of the issues they talked about, but a lively linguistic wrangling, getting things right at the sentence level, making things stranger than they already are, the better for us to understand them, I think. And that has been tremendously exciting to watch. I think also the literature is, as all good literature is, a search for some kind of home, in just the home that a single sentence can make. My first novel, when it came out, I mean, that's back in 2010, that feels like a long time ago, the entire novel was structured on the peripatetic within Ireland, if one can imagine that, moving around and searching for a home in that. So it's been interesting to see how that sort of search has been playing out in modern writing. Very lively.
Belinda, account for your work, and there's some wonderful connections between the two of you.
Account for my work. Well, my novels are very different to one another, and the first one could be seen very much as being in the Irish mould. It's a family story. It's about the struggle between father and son. It's between the struggle between the rural and the urban. With the second one, I wanted to do something different. It's always, in terms of talking about it, in terms of a tradition, it's not something I find easy to do. I think that you're always, as a writer, you're in the room with your work alone. It doesn't feel like part of anything. It's only afterwards, in interviews and in contexts like this, that we're invited to think about the larger picture. The scene is really exciting at the moment. I agree with Mary. It's also very productive. You know, when I published Solace in 2011, I think there were 2 debut novels that year. Now there are probably 10 to 15 a year. So there's a lot of writing coming out of the country. There are a lot of people writing. There are a lot of people getting published. The community is very vibrant. The writing is very irreverent. It's kicking very consciously against a sense of a tradition. as Mary said, there's a sort of linguistic explosiveness to the work. People like Kevin Barry, Colin Barrett, Emer McBride, whose novel A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing was such a sensation two years ago. So there is something that looks very different happening. I think it's also something very old. It has been happening always, that kind of work. Now it's maybe more to the fore.
You come into the game with so many advantages, but notably for me that you come from it from an experimental and modern and global post-colonial perspective, if you choose it, but also from place in the canon already. The tradition behind you is huge, and it's connected. But maybe pick up on some of the words, the post-Christian Ireland, but also the darkness in so much of this work.
The darkness is there. I mean, I don't think this is exclusively Irish. I think that if you reflect on human life, if you write stories about people, if you write stories about the way that people treat one another and are to one another, darkness will pervade that story to some extent. But it is true. I mean, we saw this during the boom years, for instance. There wasn't very much fiction coming out of the country then. That's often talked of, or there didn't seem to be. But what was coming out in terms of fiction and in terms of theatre was very... was dark work, was unhappy work, during a time when it seemed like the country was very prosperous and that things were going very well. So I think that the writing will always pick up on the true undercurrent of what's happening in the country. You know, that's sort of our... Maybe that's our job, or that's our ability, or what we're resigned to as writers, to sort of pick up on the true pulse of what's happening, maybe at a psychic level.
Mary, and maybe Colin too, make what you will of a funny connection in the Grandest Stories. Mm. Can't tell the stories, but all three of you write stories that where place, the language is sounds like Ireland often, but the places could be anywhere. Colm's is in Berlin. Mary, yours... We think it's in Ireland, but then no, it turns out it's all in an American setting. Mm-hmm. The West means one thing here and another thing in Ireland. And Belinda, yours could be anywhere. It could be New York. It could almost be, not Paris, but it could surely be Dublin or London, maybe Boston on a lively day. What does that tell you? That the Irish imagination is sort of setting itself down all over the place, comfortably everywhere.
I think particularly in the early draft of writing, I'm very wary of dropping one of those, I don't know what they call them on the Google Maps, dropping a pin, right?
Yeah, a little red pin.
Dropping a literary pin that makes a place so very obvious. Now, maybe I should try it a little more, but I was interested to see how far I could get, not in masquerading or masking the story as an Irish story for a Southern story, because the Gulf Shores are the Gulf Shores and they are nowhere south in Ireland. So stripping place out only to put it back in, to feel one's way back in the drafting process of writing is interesting to me. I'm also kind of thinking, and I've written about this recently for Grant and an essay, about the American writer Joy Williams, who gave, I think, a great gift to American writers and expatriate writers, liminal figures, I might call them, when she enjoined American writers to consider more carefully the sprawl and smallness of America, she said, its greedy optimism and its dangerous sentimentality. And as, you know, somewhat of an outsider, you go, oh, what a perfect capturing of things, but what a great invitation as well to study more deeply and look at those details with great empathy and try to inhabit them in a story.
Does your writing have an address, Colin?
Well, I think that, you know, Ireland has always connected to the outside world, and Irish writing to, you know, Ireland to England, Ireland to America, Ireland to Rome. But I think Ireland to Germany is one of the new things. For example, I noticed in Belinda McKeown's book, I mean, Tender, the whole idea of someone coming home from Germany becomes the important moment in the book. But they come home to a Dublin, which is around the corner from the Dublin I live in. And you can say, oh, right, we're in Dublin again. No, we're not. We're in a new Dublin. You can say, you know, that, that every writer who has made a Dublin has made a new one. Mm-hmm. And the one that you make is the contemporary one, or is one that I absolutely now recognise as being the bars I pass at night, the sense of young people moving in and out of the country, the sense of sexuality being fluid and open, the sense of people being controlling their own destinies and yet the dramas remaining deep and serious ones. Mm. That it's not just everyone has been liberated from everything just because they've been liberated from Catholicism. So that I notice in your book, Belinda, a sort of Dublin that you've made in your own image, that it's not as though you've been looking at Joyce's Dubliners or Patrick Kavanagh's Dublin, but it is a modern it is a modern Dublin with its own manners and its own habits, as though somehow you have written the city for the first time, as though you have actually made a new tradition for the city, which is, I think, is an important element.
Yeah, well, I think we're never really thinking about the past representations of a city when we're trying to capture it. I mean, it's often. It can look like that from the outside, I think. It can look like that or seem like that in an academic context, maybe when the narratives seem to match up to one another or to be speaking to one another across generations. But again, when you sit down with your unfinished manuscript and you're trying to capture the feel of a place, whether it be a city or a field, that's your take on it. And it comes, it's just your blueprint, your set of
it's interestingly different in spirit from the end of The Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. But you read in all this work, you feel so many Stephen Dedalus's or Stephanie Dedalus's heading out for the great experiences of life, as he did, and as Joyce, in fact, of course, did. But you also sense whether they're refugees from the dark towns of the West or just taking advantage of the new opportunities of a global culture, they won't be coming back to Ireland anytime soon.
Yes, I mean, I think one of the heroic presences in Ireland in my lifetime has been John Banville, and the fact that every two or three years a new novel appears, novels which can reach outwards, which, for example, Kepler, Copernicus, can deal with the great matters which formed contemporary Europe, and then a book like The Book of Evidence, which takes in Dublin and crime, and then his crime novels, which have also dealt with a sort of Dublin of the 50s leading up into now, but all the time concerned with the big question, if you're a writer, the question of style. The question of how are you going to make the next sentence matter? How are you going to make it original? And I think he is the high priest that almost governs the business now, in the same way as perhaps Edna O'Brien. It doesn't matter that she's lived in London, and it doesn't matter in a way what their subjects have been. Their subjects have been style. They have been deeply concerned with the paragraph and the sentence and the adjective and the tone. And I think if you look at the work of Mary and Belinda, I think if you look at the work of Lisa and Colin, who you have on, I think that issue of what am I going to do now with the music? What am I going to do with the tonality? And I think it's something that Stephen Dedalus was acutely conscious of, that when he was on his way, what he had in mind was stately, plump Buck Mulligan, you know, like the style, just the stylistic levels within Ulysses. And I think it's come again and again and again, not in a way as a response to reality in Ireland, but as a response to the sort of musical possibilities of prose, that each writer is actually putting up a flag saying, I have a new melody, I have a new sound I'm making. And I think that's what you're finding as much as anything else, as much as a battle against Catholicism or a battle against cliche or a battle against myth or a battle against your own town or village. It's an attempt to forge a new style. And that's what you're watching. And that is creating in Ireland at the moment a very exciting place to be, because you're watching writers forming this for the first time. And you're waiting for John Banville's book next year as he goes into his 70s, and as Edna O'Brien publishes The Red Chairs in her 80s, it's still going on. As Belinda says, you're on your own in a room, and your main problem is, what am I going to do with the next sentence?
I laugh. I go all wobbly because I'm so glad you mentioned Edna O'Brien. I'm just well begun in The Little Red Chairs. It's an insane premise of a story. A Balkan monster fighter, Karadzic or somebody, turns up in Connemara as a wannabe sex therapist or something. And it begins in a bar where everybody's meeting the gent. But every single sentence in that story, it just kicks up its heels. It takes your breath away. There's a gasp of delight and just a complete master at work. Philip Roth says, he's always loved Edna O'Brien, but he says this is the masterpiece, and she's well into her ninth decade. Do you want to compete in tributes to Edna O'Brien?
Or I love Edna. How we love that woman. Her work has been hugely important to me. I just wanted to plug another Irish novel that I'm reading at the moment, which has just come out in Ireland, which is Mike McCormack's new book, Solar Bones, and it's just superb. I think it'll probably be coming out here in the US next year. It's one single sentence. It's an unbroken sentence, book-long sentence, and it's wonderful. But there's so much great work coming out.
Called Finnegan's Wake or something. That's astonishing. Colin, we're going to bottle that last speech of yours about writing in Ireland today. Mary O'Donoghue is nodding. Thank you. Coming up, everybody knows the symptoms of Irish Alzheimer's. You forget everything but the grudges. In Ireland, though, you meet young people who are lightening that baggage and many who are getting over the old Irish hang-ups about what used to be called too beautiful to talk about. Spelled S-E-X. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. This is the news of Ireland 100 years after the Easter Uprising of 1916. It was the start of a second century in Ireland's modern age. We're speaking with the writers Belinda McKeown, Mary O'Donoghue, and Colm Tobin. As it happens, I was in Ireland, east and west, last spring, just after a watershed campaign and vote across Ireland that legalized same-sex marriage, a huge break from the clichés about Irish Puritanism. I had to wonder if Irish Americans would have given gay marriage the same landslide permission. But in my own unscientific sampling of students at the National College of Art and Design, 20-somethings at Dublin's premier art school, all manner of identity issues were being shared openly. Our intern, Grant Holub-Mormon, distilled these voices.
It was a real surprise, and it was something that happened where we were kind of, I guess, just kept crying because it was so moving or something, to have it be the percentage that it was and so emblematic of what's happening.
99% of the people who voted in that referendum would have gone through 12 years of Catholic or Church of Ireland education. They would have all come out of, the same school system, and yet we had a majority yes vote, and it was completely counter to what they would have been taught in school, and people were proud. You walked along any street in Dublin, any street in the country, and everyone had a yes badge, and there was no shame about it. And it was everybody. It was like straight people, gay people, bi people. It was amazing. It was palpable that people wanted a change and that this was an issue that people were just really, really pushing for. It was an un-Irish sense of activity around the place.
Everyone in my family felt the same way about it, I think, and my parents have had to come to terms with my sister being gay, my dad particularly, but I think now that he has come to terms with that more in the last 5 or 10 years, he wouldn't have dreamt of voting no.
I was surprised, I guess, at the level of the yes vote from those areas, and that still surprises me. It makes me really proud that I was proven wrong about my own area. It was an overwhelming yes, and I don't know, I think it's just, for me, the whole yes vote was just a stripping away of a mask and a reputation that Ireland had.
Did families fight about it? Did you talk about it with parents, with brothers and sisters?
I come from like a really rural background, and my dad is a stereotypical silent Irish farmer who will grumble about politics, but he won't he won't talk about things like that. And then my mother is quite liberal. So it was really interesting seeing her trying to bring this into the house and, you know, bring this issue up. I was sitting at the kitchen table with my parents while they were eating dinner, and we were watching the vote being counted in Dublin Castle. And I was just in tears because you could actually sense the emotion and just the feeling in Dublin Castle. And, you know, my parents were like, this is pretty good. But it was just, I couldn't explain to them what this meant.
How did your papa vote?
How did my papa vote? He voted yes.
I'm Christopher Lydon. We're back in Boston with Colin Devine, Mary O'Donoghue, and Belinda McCune. Colin, what did you make of the transformation? Was it a big change? Was it something surfacing? Were you shocked, surprised, thrilled?
There's a book coming out this week edited by the journalist Charlie Bird, who was involved in the campaign and going around the country, getting people's stories and getting public forums going. And he was so moved by what he heard that he edited a book. I've read the book. The book is filled with pain. It's filled with people being bullied, with dreadful things happening, with people going to England to get away, and then dreadful things happening to them there. There was a huge, and there is a huge sense of pain. Now, this was one way. I mean, it was really important, I think, that it was a national referendum, a national debate, rather than a mere act of parliament, that actually will cause something new to occur, but it is only the beginning, because the account, for example, of bullying in schools, the account of hatred within communities, the account of gay boys, lesbian girls trying to walk down the street in the place they're from in recent years, being insulted and you know, driven insane in this book is really extraordinary. So we felt great about ourselves that day. It's a very Irish thing in a way. Let's have one day where we think we're great. My father voted yes, my mother voted yes, my granny voted yes. Well, actually, when you read this book, you realise, well, it's about time they did. And so, you know, it was a great day to bring the rainbow flag into the yard of Dublin Castle on a Saturday and have all the leaders of the country there and all the gay people arriving in pairs and in groups. Was a great day for Ireland. But when I just forgot in a way about what it had been like. But this book, this new book edited by Charlie Bird, was shocking for me just because it reminded me of just how much pain this comes from.
Belinda, everybody at NCAD, the art school, had a story, family or your own experience. What's yours of this whole rethinking, this new face of...
I agree with Colm. I was actually there that weekend. I flew home to vote. I was in Dublin Castle when the vote came in. It was an extraordinary day, but the next day was already time to move on to the next thing. What's next? One of the things for me, that I'm not alone in this, that's next is women's rights in Ireland. Women are second-class citizens in Ireland. Abortion is still illegal under even the circumstances which pose a dire risk to the health of the mother. The Repeal the Eighth campaign is probably the campaign that people are trying to give a lot of energy to at the moment to get visibility for in the media. It's difficult. Listening, I was very moved by the voices at the top of the broadcast from ordinary Irish people talking about what the 1916 Rising meant to them. And that woman talking about equality, it was a proclamation for Irish men and Irish women, equality for all.
Yes.
We're not there yet. I was very, very proud to stand in Dublin Castle that day. It was incredibly moving. But there are so many other jobs of work that we must do together as a nation. And one of those is to recognise women as full citizens.
There were so many other aspects of identity that came up with the students in Dublin when I was there, including the post-Christian thing, which is not unrelated to the sexual and gender thing. But what struck me was that it's not a kind of repudiation of an incredibly rich spiritual tradition in Ireland. People talk very persuasively about music, about dance, about spiritual life. This was not a kind of church burning thing, but it was going to be. It's going to be different. Mary, do you want to?
Yeah,
do I make any sense?
Yes, it's interesting to hear you think through it in those terms, Chris. Particularly with respect to the spirituality of music and those literary traditions. But I'm also deeply interested in what Belinda said, which is the what next. And it reminds me of Cullum's galvanic discussion of Irish writing at the level of style. What's going to happen in the next sentence is the true excitement. So what is that next sentence that will be written, that will be created? I watched it from afar, and now I'm sort of moved all over again to hear those voices talking about it. It's not lost on me that a story that I was writing some months in advance of the referendum, about a gay couple, middle-aged men, I set it in Norway, and I'm sort of wondering if perhaps I did so because I was afraid of hexing things somehow by setting that story in Ireland. But yeah, it's been a thrilling time, but a time to do more work.
Belinda?
We still don't have a government in Ireland. I just want to point that out. 70 days tomorrow, they've been fighting over forming the government.
We may not have one here in a day now, so who are we?
We'll see. We'll feel sorry for you when the time comes. I think the time may come. But at the moment, it has been a very interesting time, I think, to mark the centenary of the 1916 Rising, put it that way. Because, you know, one of the chief questions is, what are we celebrating? It's very important to look back, and, you know, Cullum's lens on that time is so extraordinary and detailed. I mean, the historic texture of that is just, it's really inspiring and moving. But to think about the hundred years that followed, the country that we made and the country that we live in, most of us don't actually live there, but are still deeply connected to it. I mean, I think that's what many writers are, if not in the form of reportage or in direct response, we're very preoccupied with what life is like now.
Yeah,
for human beings in Ireland.
Let me try out a tourist Irish American generalization about the writing and the voices. It strikes me that whole point that the church is over is very clear, and yet the Irish people speak of themselves as almost inherently blessed. They're expressive. They're musical. They're funny. God knows they're charming. People are still poor in Ireland. And there's a lot less to fall back on in the way of family, farming. But the world now, for them, is borderless. There's a kind of affirmative action for Irish voices in the world, it seems to me. As well as there's a welcome for Polish plumbers and for African refugees who come in and out of Ireland when they have to. It's almost normal. But Ireland feels, more than ever, it seems to me, at home in the world.
Yeah,
is it possible?
I just want to take up something Belinda said and that Mary touched on. Is I think the H word, the hypocrite word, has to be included here. That we will get a new government, and I can guarantee you the new government, whether it lasts 2 years or 3 years, will not repeal the Eighth Amendment, which is the abortion referendum, because they're afraid. So since 1984, 5,000 women a year have gone to England to have abortions. Speaking of no borders, they have crossed on cheap flights or on, you know, to England, and they have come home and not told anybody. That level of pain, of silence, is in the society now, buried deep within it. Our aunts, our mothers, our sisters, our cousins have all had abortions and not told anybody. And there's nothing about it publicly in the society. Medically, it's a disaster, because if you have a problem when you come home, you don't have anywhere to go with your medical problem, even, let alone your psychological problem.
Yeah, I mean, to put it in perspective, I mean, 5,000 women a year, 700 women have travelled since the government started trying to form government 70 days ago. That's how many women have travelled to England to terminate a pregnancy. And it's not just the women coming home. I mean, they have been sent, they have to go there under terrible circumstances, regardless of the reasons for which they need to terminate a pregnancy. This is the real stuff. I mean, this is not maybe the pleasant, charming, bucolic version of Ireland, but this is what the texture of people's lives there at the moment. And it's really serious, and we're really serious about it.
Mary?
I think the kind of the mobility that is sort of celebrated as an Irish achievement, the Irish can go everywhere in pretty quick order and turn it around, has a terrible kind of coefficient in that secret mobility that you're talking about, Belinda, which are those short, one might say, but extremely difficult passages to source an abortion. And I find that sort of, that idea of mobility and its sort of secret life for these women unacceptable and terribly sad.
I mean, we talked about Edna O'Brien and how wonderful she is. And in her memoir in the 70s, she described Ireland as a land of strange, throttled, sacrificial women. Mm-hmm. I knew that must have seemed as though it would no longer be the case, and that as though it was some sort of ridiculous fantasy, even at the time. It may seem a very dramatic description, but when you look at the facts, it's pretty close to what life is like for many, many women and many people in Ireland.
Colm Tremain, tell the story I've heard from you before about the former president of Ireland.
Mary McAleese still has a lot of power in Ireland. She was president for 14 years, and she's a Catholic, and she's very serious about her religion. And it was a wonderful intervention in the gay referendum, where she came back into the country in about a week before the referendum, and she made a really wonderful, serious speech, because she's also a constitutional lawyer, but she's also a mother. So she's a constitutional lawyer. Her arguments were brilliant and really precise. But when she spoke about her family, she said, well, I have twins. Justin is gay and the other twin is not. How can I tell these two children born on the same day that one of them has a right in Ireland, the other one does not have? And that mixing of the personal and the political, of the serious abstract argument and the personal statement, I think made a very big difference. And it was the personal, it was the constant use of the personal that turned the referendum. People talking about their children, or people talking softly about themselves. It was a sort of soft campaign. And Mary McAleese's involvement in it was, brilliantly articulate. And it would be wonderful if figures such as Mary McAleese would now enter into the debate, the next debate we need to have, the seriously difficult one, which is the subject of abortion, of the appeal of the Eighth Amendment.
I'm trying at all costs to avoid sentimentality about the Irish, because... Of course, I am one of them in a certain way, but is not that articulateness of Mary McAleese sort of what the world needs and what the world treasures about the Irish imagination?
Well, we admire it in Hillary Clinton, too.
Interesting. If you're still, this is for listeners, if you're still classifying your moods and all that history, the poet Tom French in County Kilkenny has a framework for you. He titled his poem simply 1916.
Nineteen sixteen is currently unable to come to the phone. Please listen to the following options and select one. If you are livid, incandescent, or apoplectic with rage, please press 1 now. If you are ringing to let off steam about all that this miserable little country, where even the saints are vindictive, has done to destroy any chance you ever had at something even vaguely resembling a life, please press 6 now. If the gulf between the beautiful ideals read out to a handful of rubberneckers and what has become of those ideals takes your absolute breath away, please press 7 now. If you are elderly, sick, a child, unexpectedly pregnant, dying, addicted, hopeless, harmless, homeless, or in any way in need of assistance, God help you now. If you would like to recite the Proclamation of the Republic in the style of Marlon Brando in The Godfather, please press 8 now. If you would like to speak to an operator, you have clearly not been paying sufficient attention. Once the current generation, whose calls are currently on hold, has joined the glorious dead generations, all calls will be answered in strict rotation. Your call is important to 1916. Please, stay on the line.
Thank you, Tom French, Mary O'Donoghue, Belinda McKeown, Colm Tobin. Thanks also to Colin Barrett and Lisa McInerney, and to Eamon Little for his invaluable recording help in Ireland. Thanks also to Suzanne Williams for assembling our granted guests. You can hear more magic from Colm Tobin on our website, talking about poetry and politics, as well as a longer version of our Irish conversations after the same-sex marriage vote, on the web at radioopensource.org. This week's show was produced by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Philip Garra, and Abby Duker. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our mother superior. I'm Christopher Lydon. Sláinte. And join us next time on Open Source.